This morning, I'm going to talk about how do we do conflict, and then how do we go about sexuality and marriage to the glory of God. So first, I'm going to dig in and talk about how we can fight as husbands and wives in ways that are actually good. So when we think about conflict in marriage, again, there's a few topics you could pick. There's practical and essentialized. How do you go about your conflicts? We think about painful experiences in marriage. We think about some of the hardest stuff in marriage. Usually it's going to revolve around a conflict, a fight. You say something you regret. You say something that's painful. You can say something that does relational damage that takes time to repair and heal. Conflict's gone wrong, and the scriptures, just like our words, have enormous power to destroy good things. Conflicts in marriage, again, can leave us with deep wounds that we have to work hard to repair and heal. And it's my experience, I think, in counseling couples that conflicts often leave us really dejected and discouraged about marriage at various times. They can leave us feeling exhausted. You ever had a fight in your marriage or a conflict where you feel like you're living in Groundhog Day? Because it's like the same pattern that just comes up. You see it coming, and there's nothing I can do to stop it, and I know what I'm going to say, I know my wife is going to say, and we're just stuck. Like, we kind of go through the cycle of this particular fight, this particular conflict, this particular argument, that we just kind of repeat again, again, and again, and again, right? So conflict's gone bad can be very discouraging for us. So often when conflicts begin to be that way, there's an enormous spiritual battle that you face, right? This is when you hear the voice of evil speaking to you the most profoundly, telling you your marriage is never going to change. You're stuck. You're broken. This won't get better. It'll just stay this way. So again, you can begin to feel enormous temptation to really despair. So again, my counseling experience, chronic unresolved conflicts, where you feel like you're having the same one again and again, and you're stuck. It can really be some of the most discouraging, kind of dejecting experiences, I think, of marriage. So my goal today is, first, we're going to talk about some biblical truths about conflict that are important. Then we're going to talk about some of the common ingredients involved and strategies involved in our sinful conflicts that we see repetitively. And then at the end, we're going to talk about how do we do our conflict in redemptive ways. All right, so first, some key biblical things at the very beginning, really important, that we have to see from the outset. First, conflict isn't necessarily wrong. And for some of us, that's hard to believe for a variety of reasons. If you read the scriptures, the very beginning of the Bible starts with a story that's really about conflict right away, right? In Genesis 3, where we see God declaring that there's going to be a fight. There's going to be a conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, and one day the seed of the woman's going to crush. He's going to have this fight with the serpent, and he's going to win, basically. Rich yesterday alluded to this great passage in Revelation 19, right? The Bible starts with the promise of a conflict, and then the Bible ends in Revelation with the fulfillment of King Jesus is going to come with armies of heaven, and he's going to fight Satan and crush evil forever. So this is important because it teaches us that conflict is not inherently bad. It's not inherently our enemy in marriage. So conflict goes bad when Satan and evil get involved and do lots of damage in conflict. But the fact that we have a disagreement or an argument or a conflict is not in and of itself always necessarily sinful. And again, some of us have a hard time believing this because maybe you grew up in a house where when you were little, you had no framework for how to do conflict in a way that was redemptive. You saw conflicts go bad all the time. Where it was screaming, yelling, where it was sinful, crushing anger, where it was nasty words. And so we have a hard time believing, again, that conflict actually can be done in a redemptive way. And it has to be done. Like, you can't avoid your conflicts. A lot of times avoiding your conflicts in marriage really creates, I would say, more destruction than not being afraid of them and knowing how to navigate kind of your conflicts. So the scriptures give us a vision of the Christian life that is far from conflict-free. It's filled with conflict, with Satan, a conflict that has been decisively won the Lord Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension. So that's an important truth. All right, we've already alluded to this, but the second foundational truth is conflict goes bad, it goes wrong when Satan and evil get involved with our conflicts. We can think about the first marriage fight of sorts that we see kind of in infancy in the Bible, when Adam and Eve first sin, and they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and we're told that they're filled with shame because of their nakedness. They feel exposed. They feel vulnerable. They feel guilty, and they want to hide. So they go and they run and they hide from God. And then God calls them to account. We mentioned this yesterday, but this is a huge passage that gives us lots of truths about how our marriages work. When God calls them to account, what do? Well, they hide and they avoid responsibility. They want to blame each other. Adam blames his wife, and he's going to subtly indict God as well. It's the woman that you gave me. The woman blames the serpent. So how do you think the woman felt when Adam basically said, oh, by the way, it's all my wife's fault? She was probably really mad. Probably made her really angry, thinking, you're the one that got us into this mess? How do you think Adam felt when he blamed his wife for the mess that they were in? I don't know for certain, but I imagine he probably felt pretty bad about it. Felt guilty. Maybe he was really ashamed. Maybe he was just really afraid what was going to happen if he took responsibility for his sin. So you can really see right off the bat, all the building blocks, I think, of a lot of our conflicts are right at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis 3. The first marriage fight was about guilt. It was about anger. It was about not taking responsibility. It was about shame. It was about fear. We see all of these things lurking in a lot of our conflicts that we have in marriage. How difficult it is in the midst of feeling like you've been wronged to stop and think about, are there ways I've contributed to this? Or is it really just very quickly become all about why this is my spouse's fault and I'm very angry about this and I'm going to come up with some very good accusations to indict you, basically. So what we see in Genesis 3 is, this idea that is very crucial in our conflicts, that really, like, Adam and Eve had a conflict before their first marriage conflict. And that first conflict was actually the ways that they had made war against God and rebelled against Him. That was the bigger, deeper conflict that took place before they accused each other, before they blamed each other. And the same is true for us. And we don't see this. In the midst of your marriage fight, we don't see that first there's been a vertical spiritual movement away from God that husbands and wives have first done. And as a result, now we're going to fight each other. We're going to blame each other. That's very difficult for us. But we have to do this in the midst of conflicts. We have to slow down your anger and slow down the conflict. And you have to begin thinking about, What are ways that we have really turned away from what God has told us to do and how He's called us to live? So our marriage conflicts, they always originate when one or two people, first, they're going to turn from God. They're going to sin against Him. They're going to run from Him in some way. They're going to hide from Him. And this is what begins creating the relational mess that we so often see in our marriages and our conflicts. So again, it's very important, I think, in the midst of conflicts that we can stop for a few moments. We can slow down the pace, right, of your anger. We can ask ourselves some really important things. We can ask ourselves, both as husbands and wives, what are ways I've listened to evil in this moment as opposed to fighting it? What are ways that my heart is turned against God and how He's called me to live? What were the first steps that I took, or maybe my spouse took, away from God so that now we are opposed to each other, we want to fight each other? So often in marriage conflict, we feel anger, you feel attacked, and immediately the cycle is attack and defend, attack and defend. I'm going to attack you, I'm going to defend myself, you're going to attack me, you're going to defend yourself. But again, we have to see that there's another spiritual battle that's way more important than what's happening between you and your spouse, and that is the ways both husbands and wives turn away from God in the midst of their conflicts and ways that have happened prior to their conflicts. The most helpful scriptures, I think, thinking about how we do conflicts in marriage is Ephesians 6:12. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So again, same idea of what we're saying here. Your spouse is not your enemy in this is your conflict. That's what your flesh wants you to believe. That's what evil wants you to believe. But your spouse is not the greatest enemy. Satan and evil are your greatest enemy. And you've been seduced into thinking your spouse is the biggest problem, your biggest enemy that you need to fight in this moment. So let's think practical about how this might play out. Anybody ever get into arguments about money in your marriage? I hope we're not the only one. What does this fight look like? Here's a scenario. So let's say a husband confronts his wife about a conversation that quickly gets heated about money that's been spent. He does not like the way the money has been spent. So he comes and begins the conversation with a posture that's really adversarial. It's about an attack. It's about, why did you do this? This was wrong. This was bad. Can we talk about this? That's a good thing to say. But it's very adversarial and it gets heated very quickly. It's about attack and defend. Maybe the wife isn't spending the money in the best way. In some ways, that's a little bit irrelevant. Conversation about how to wisely spend your money is good. You have to get on the same page about that. But partly what makes this conflict bad and not a productive conversation is all the spiritual stuff happening inside of husbands and wives when they're talking about their money. So for example, let's say the husband is really afraid that God's not going to provide enough for his family. So what do you think he goes into that conversation with? A lot of anxiety and fear about their financial situation. And is God really going to be the one that's going to provide for them? And maybe the husband has been living like the checking account, right, is his refuge and his strength, a very present help in trouble. So already he's kind of turned away from what God has said about God's going to promise to be the one to provide for them. And he's listened to the voice of evil, even in ways he doesn't see and understand, that tells him that, look, God doesn't care about your family. This is all on you, dude. And if you do not keep account of every last dollar and make sure that every last dollar is spent to the penny the way it should be, it's going to be a disaster for you and your family. So again, like, the spiritual dynamic here is happening before he ever starts accusing his wife of anything is really important. The husband listening to this voice of fear and anxiety telling these things has fed this lust for control over the money, even in the midst of him wanting to make wise decisions about the money. So unless the husband can slow down enough and carefully consider the spiritual battle that he's already been fighting before the conversation even started, the conversation is just going to be all about why it's his wife's fault. And he's going to be hostile, and he's going to be angry, and he's going to completely miss, like, what he has brought to the table to make this a bad conflict. So what's important to see is that these deeper spiritual battles, they really affect your conflicts, and they actually affect what you hear, too. Because lots of times in conflicts where you're very sure that your spouse has accused you or condemned you or judged you in some way, then we have actually way more to do with you than your spouse. Sometimes you are accused, but I'm convinced a lot of times in marriage, again, like, your flesh will actually change the way you interpret the things that you hear. So again, we can think about Genesis 3 again. When God asks Adam and Eve, where are you? And then he calls them to account and says, what is this, you know, that you have done? I think it's very possible. We don't know this for sure. There's a little bit of speculation here. But I think what's very possible is that neither the man nor the woman really heard God's questions. I think because they're so full of guilt and shame and fear, I think they just assumed that God was questioning them in order to condemn them and not rescue them from their sin. And again, we see the same dynamic all the time at work in our marriages and couples that I work with. Your own spiritual battles have this amazing ability to create accusations that really aren't there, or they're not really meant to be intended the way that you hear them. So your flesh always wants to distort what your spouse is actually saying. Our spiritual battles have the ability to twist and distort and interpret all kinds of things. So we need to consider a lot of the defensiveness you feel in the midst of your conflict. It may actually have way more to do with your own spiritual battle with evil than it does your spouse condemning you. And if you begin to see that, you can begin to be a lot less defensive in your conflicts. Okay. Let's talk about ways conflicts go wrong. Those are some crucial kind of biblical things to think about at the beginning. What are some of the common ingredients? All of our fights have a couple things going on probably all at one time. The first thing we're talking about the longest is what we see in every fight, every conflict gone wrong. It's anger, like sinful anger. So let's talk about anger for just a second, because anger is such a huge, important emotion and such a huge, important response. A couple of basic parts of anger that are really important to understand, that are really good, actually. Anger consists of at least two basic things, two basic components. You're making two simultaneous statements at the same time every time you get mad. First of all, you're saying, hey, this really matters. This is really important. This is worth some emotional energy. This is worth a conversation, a conflict, or an argument. You don't get angry about the things that you value very little. So in anger, you're saying that something has happened to you that you think is really important, that is valuable. Second, anger is also not only a value judgment, it's a moral judgment as well. You're saying this matters, and you're saying, hey, that's wrong. It shouldn't be that way. I'm opposed to that. The fact that we get angry, again, is a part of what it means to be made in the image of God. We can quickly see the goodness of godly anger by thinking about what would it be like in a world where nobody got angry? What would it be like if you heard stories of child abuse or murder or rape or adultery, and nobody got angry about these things? David Pallison, I quoted him last night. He's a guy I like to read a lot. He says, when the standard of judgment is accurate and the way of reacting is constructive, then clear-minded, hearty disapproval is one of the best things going. Moral sanity must disapprove of wrong, and that disapproval is the essence of anger. Every time you're mad, you're saying, that matters a lot to me. You're saying, I think this is wrong. This is morally wrong. All right, another thing about anger we have to see is that, again, like our conflicts that involve anger aren't inherently bad, necessarily. Anger doesn't have to be bad. Again, a lot of us have seen anger done bad in so many ways, it's very difficult for us to think about, how could my anger be good? How could my spouse's anger be good? But again, when we read the scriptures, we see that, in a way that's analogous to us, God experiences and expresses real anger. Psalm 7:11, God is a righteous judge who feels indignation every day. It's pretty incredible, right? Feels indignation every day. God's anger is explicit throughout the scriptures. Jesus gets angry on several occasions. And again, he demonstrates to us that perfect sinless anger is a fundamental part of who God is. So again, that tells me that anger in and of itself does not have to be evil or bad. Anger in and of itself is not my greatest enemy in marriage. Instead, it's again the way sinful grabs a hold of your anger and perverts it and twists it into something that's very destructive and very different than the kind of anger that God exhibits in his character. All right, how does our anger go bad, and what does it look like when it goes bad? I've got two things I want to talk about. First of all, sinful anger is so deceptive, isn't it? Because you just feel so right. You were very sure that you were right. And within a very quick amount of time, you become judge, jury, and executioner, and you don't hesitate on any of those. You can stand over God, you can stand over people with a self of self-righteous power. And if you don't slow down enough to think about this, you won't even hit the pause button to just consider, hey, can my anger be bad here? Could I be wrong? Is my moral judgment flawed in some way? Again, your flesh wants you to think that your moral judgments are always right. You're never wrong. So godly anger really reveals itself through humility, the willingness to consider in the midst of your conflicts that, you know what, maybe it's my fault too. It's not all my spouse's fault. You can see the deceptiveness of sinful anger in what Jesus talked about in Matthew 7, right? The log and the speck. It's a very simple but very useful way to think about how you talk about people and their sin, right? Jesus says you deal with this huge log in your own eye. You slow down. You think about your own sins. And then you can think about the faults of other people. So in marital conflicts, we reverse this very quickly, right? Very quickly, it's about why my spouse is the biggest problem. I'm going to focus all my time, energy, and effort on showing them why they're wrong, and maybe I'll slightly consider ways that I could have done something wrong. Another way anger is very deceptive, a lot of times it's a smokescreen that you don't see you're using in the moment. And you can use it as a smokescreen to actually hide deeper, more painful things that you don't want to talk about with your spouse. Often you can use anger to hide from the fact that, you know what, I feel really ashamed over something that I did, but I don't want to tell you that. Anger can be used to anesthetize the pain of shame or, again, other things that are very hard for you to face and hard for you to admit to your spouse. For many of us in marriage, it's far easier to blow up and get mad than to tell your spouse, you know what, that really hurt when he said this. I was so confused when this happened. Some of us feel much more comfortable expressing anger than fear or anxiety. It's way easier to get mad about something than to say, you know what, I was really afraid in this moment when you said this. So when you feel anger in your marital conflicts, I want you to start thinking about what are the other things here that anger is just covering completely over that are just as important that we're not talking about. Things that are making you feel a lot more vulnerable to actually say, you know, to your spouse. What are the painful emotions that need to be addressed and communicated? And again, if you can begin to do that, it'll de-escalate your conflict, right? Because suddenly now it's not all about why I'm angry at you and you've done something wrong. Now it's more about other deeper, bigger problems that you're not talking about that are just as important. That anger is going to, sinful anger will get you to ignore and not think about. All right, so anger is deceptive when it goes wrong. And anger is also revealing. And that can actually be a good thing if we can listen to your anger, because your anger is going to tell you some of the most important things that are happening inside of you that you may not want to think about, things that you really need to consider in light of God's Word. There are a few things that will accurately reflect what you value the most, what you think matters the most, like your anger, right? In any particular moment in your anger, you're saying, I think this matters. And usually you're saying, I think this matters more than anything else. Anger will expose what you value the most. It'll expose sometimes even what you worship the most. This is more valuable than anything else. This is what we need more than anything else. It'll show you what you desire the most. Your anger is a great diagnostic tool to help you see whether or not you want to live for God and honor Him, or whether or not you want to live for your unselfish purposes. So in the midst of your anger, think about what is this saying about me? What am I saying I value the most in the midst of my anger? Be willing to listen to what your anger exposes in you, even if your anger exposes something you really would rather not face to begin, because it's ugly and it's gross, something you need to think about repenting of. A willingness to carefully consider what drives your anger is a very redemptive moment for you in the midst of conflict. All right, so before we move on quickly, some key questions. To cross-examine yourself in the midst of sinful anger. Some things you have to be willing to ask yourself, again, in the midst of conflict, that will slow down the pace of the marital fight. First, are you angry about the right things? Or does your anger reveal that really you're valuing all the wrong things in the midst of this moment? Is your anger saying in the midst of this moment that my love for control or approval or comfort really matters more than my spouse, matters more than my marriage? We should ask ourselves, am I willing to consider that my anger could be making the wrong moral judgment? Am I actually calling something sin that the Bible would say is sin? Or am I just angry because someone has made demands of my time or my energy or asked me to do something that I don't want to do? Are you angry about having your sin exposed? Is your anger reflecting more of God's righteous anger or sinful perversion of it? Is your anger productive? Godly anger will actually have some good things that will flow from it. It'll energize you to do redemptive things. But you can think about the fruit of our sinful anger and you just see a trail of destruction behind it. You'll see people that don't trust each other. You'll see hateful words. You'll still see people that cower in fear. You'll see lots of bad things that come from it. Okay, so that's the first ingredient of all of our conflicts. We're going to involve sinful anger, anger that's gone wrong or bad. I've got several things. For the sake of time, I just want to talk about one more thing in the midst of sinful conflicts that are really important. A lot of times in the midst of sinful conflicts, what you really see is desire that's gone off the rails. So a key component of anger that James talks about is this. One of the things you can ask yourself in the midst of your anger that's really important is, what do you really want? And what are you willing to do to get it in the midst of your fight? If you're willing to harm your spouse or damage your marriage in order to get something that you want, you really need to consider the likelihood that either you just want something sinful or something good for you has become an idol that you are willing to do a lot of damage to get your hands on. The fruit of your desires and conflicts, again, will be a good indicator of whether or not your desires have taken an idolatrous turn and it's something you need to repent of, or whether this is something actually good that's going to bless my marriage. We desire good things in marriage. We want approval. We want affirmation. We want sexual intimacy. We want lots of other things. These are all good things that God made us to experience in marriage. My question is, what happens if we don't get what you want in your marriage? What next? Anger and disappointment, maybe. And those things aren't necessarily sinful. But is your response to be opposed to your spouse when you don't get what you want? So that you're now my enemy, and I want to hurt you in some way, emotionally, verbally. Your response of not getting a good thing you desire in marriage, again, is a good indicator of what's happening in your heart, and is the desire something that has stayed within good, God-honoring boundaries? Or is this become an idol for you that you're willing to do a lot of damage in order to get? Something that's going to fill you with rage and bitterness and a lot of anger when it's taken from you. Desires that honor God and serve our spouse are desires that are able to be long-suffering in order for you to experience. They're desires that can be frustrated or even denied at times, and yet there still remains a commitment in you to love your spouse and to move towards them. When you don't get what you want in marriage, what do you do? Do you want to punish your spouse? Do you want to shut down emotionally? Do you want to stop talking to him or her? Maybe you just become really withdrawn and sullen and depressed. Again, these are all good indicators that good desires within your marriage have gone off the rails, and they've become a master that you serve, an idol that your heart is willing to do anything to get, a desire that's really become your ultimate source of joy and fulfillment, something that occupies a space that I would say only God should fill that space in your life. Some of the anger and frustration we feel in marriages doesn't come from your spouse hurting you. It comes from the pain you feel when your spouse threatens or takes away something that we prize and we value more than God himself. Okay, those are ingredients involved in a lot of our fights that go bad. Let's talk about some of the strategies, right? Our flesh has strategies that he wants you to employ. Satan wants you to do certain things in your marital fights when they go wrong. We see a lot of these things in marriage all the time. Three things I want to mention. I'm ripping all these off from a guy named Winston Smith. I think it's helpful. He wrote a book called Marriage Matters. I think it's pretty good. All right, so the first strategy is going to be to appease in your marital fights. This first strategy of Satan in our flesh is all about getting the conflict over as soon as it starts, as quickly as possible. This conflict strategy is often driven by a heart full of fear of fighting, a fear of conflict, a fear of ever disagreeing. And the reason why this strategy for conflict is simple is because it really fails to speak the truth in love to your spouse. It's driven by fear, something that we're told throughout the scriptures is really opposed to love. Scripture says there's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. It's 1 John 4:18. Of all the fleshly patterns of conflict, I actually think this can be one of the most difficult ones to detect because it's very subtle. It can actually appear to be good on the outside sometimes. Let's say your spouse gets angry with you. You perceive that they have done something wrong, and so you're very quick to apologize right off the bat. You're very quick to give in. You're very quick to get the conflict over with as soon as possible. And again, on the surface, that may look good, right? It may look like a pretty good way to do conflict. You may pride yourself on being somebody who's quick to forgive or being a peacemaker. But underneath all this seemingly good behavior can be a heart that is terrified of actually being honest with somebody else. People who prefer to appease may get in the habit of apologizing for things you really don't mean. You say you're sorry and you're really not sorry. You're really mad. You're really angry. But you're going to say you're sorry very quickly to shut down the argument as fast as possible. And so what can happen when people do that, you actually begin to resent your spouse because you're not really being honest. You're just saying what you think you need to say to get out of the conflict as fast as possible. Again, outwardly, you could appear like a peacemaker, but inwardly, you're somebody who actually resents your spouse and can be really bitter. Appeasers are people that really struggle to know how to understand what's going on inside of you, like all the hard stuff we were talking about yesterday, to be able to communicate really important things inside of you. They've learned to kind of shut themselves down off emotionally and to apologize quickly so they don't have to feel anything negative in the midst of the conflict. People who are stuck in appeasing sometimes are people earlier who we mentioned grew up in a home that was just scary and abusive. And conflict had all kinds of terrible sinful connotations. And so you just learn from early on how to simply acquiesce in the face of conflict to stay safe emotionally or to shield yourself from verbal or physical pain. Maybe you learned in early age that life and relationships just tend to go smoother. If you just go with the flow, you don't assert yourself very much. You just apologize quickly, and you try not to think about what you feel, and you don't ever deal with what your spouse says. Shame for a lot of people is a huge heart struggle that drives people consistently to appease in conflicts. Shame's a huge deal. It's a huge way I think evil attacks people to make them feel worthless and powerless. Shame assaults the inherent value and dignity that all of us have by being made in the image of God. What shame does is it silences people by making them believe that they're really unworthy to have a voice or an opinion. So again, you're quiet in the midst of conflicts, you just quickly give in and you do what the other person says and you get out of it as soon as possible. This dynamic again, it often just happens in people that have grown up with some kind of abuse. But sometimes I see this. Sometimes I see maybe a pattern of appeasing and a biblical view of womanhood that's kind of gone off the rails and become skewed in some way. Sometimes I see women, I think, wrongly think that I'm not submitting to my wife if I ever voice my opinion to ever disagree with him. I'm not submitting to my husband, right? So it's kind of this view of submission that says a woman needs to just be quiet and passive and she never disagrees and she just keeps her mouth shut and she quickly gives in the midst of the conflict. And again, on the outside, you can look at a woman who does this and think, oh, like, she's somebody who totally gets biblical submission. But if you actually begin to think of what's happening in your own heart, this is a person who's terrified to be honest to her husband, and she's never really honest about what he says. And she's really not following his leadership, and I would say that is biblical submission, because she's not actually engaged in what he's doing and saying. She just very quickly acquiesces, agrees, and then moves on. She never actually thinks about what's happening inside of her in ways that she can follow her husband's lead. Okay, that's appeasing. The second strategy we'll talk about is ignoring or avoiding. Appeasing is a strategy that does everything to get out of conflict as soon as possible, even situations where conflict is actually necessary, where you need to have the marital fight. The strategy of ignoring, avoiding, looks like doing everything to make sure conflict never even starts. I do everything I can to just stay away from the entire thing so that we never even have the conversation. Ignoring, avoiding means that you never even show up at the battlefield to fight. You run away as soon as there's the first sign of something that can go wrong for you. And there's a lot of similarities between avoiding and appeasing, I think. Both are driven by fear. Often ignoring and avoiding can be used as like a Cold War tactic, so that once the fight is started, you're going to shut down. And you're really mad, but you're not going to say anything, right? All of us have had this conflict, right, that involves stonewalling. We have conversations in our marriage, regular basis like this. Hey, what's wrong? Nothing. But nothing is spoken with this, like, angry, intense face. It's a very icy voice. Are you sure? Because you're really mad to me. No, I'm not mad. I'm fine. A painful, awkward, you know, silence ensues. Men can do that too, by the way. All of our marriages experience this kind of thing, right? Where someone is really angry at what happened, but they're not going to be honest about it. They're not going to talk about it. This is a pattern of avoiding a conflict that can flow from a heart that is angry and resentful and hurt. Instead of moving toward the other, often what we do is we use this tactic to manipulate, right, our spouse into being the first one to move towards us. And what we're doing when we're saying that is, you have to make the first move. I will not make any movement towards you. But of course, you're not going to say this. You just want to kind of control and manipulate your spouse in this moment so they make the first move. So this tactic can be used to really exert even control in a subtle way. Again, to make your spouse be vulnerable first. You're going to apologize to me first, right, is often what's happening inside of us when we do this. When we do that kind of thing, what we're really saying is, I will make you hurt, but I'm not going to let you get close enough to me so that you'll ever hurt me. This approach makes me think a lot about one of my favorite C.S. Lewis quotes from The Four Loves. He says, to love at all is to be vulnerable. So stonewalling your spouse may make you feel safe, but it's impossible to love your spouse, you know, while you do this. The strategy is the total opposite of what we see in Jesus' words in Matthew 18. Where in Matthew 18, he actually says, look, the offended party, the person who feels like they've been sinned against, they have to go to the person who has sinned against them and have a conversation and to bring it up, right? They have to be the one to make them move to the person to say, you know what, you've hurt me in this way. It's like you've sinned against me in this way. Can we talk about it? All right, the third strategy was winning. This is a strategy that a lot of men really, really like. A lot of times it flows from a heart that's just full of pride, or it's an idolatrous craving for power or control, maybe, or a view that views any threat, a view that sees any criticism as a threat that's got to be overcome and eliminated. So this is about someone who's committed to winning the argument. You're going to go down with the ship. It doesn't matter how much damage you do. I don't care the cost. I will be right. I will prove that I'm right. I will prove that you are wrong, right? Your inner lawyer gets activated. And again, men love this one, right? Men in our flesh especially prefer this strategy, right? We devise these logical, airtight defenses. We make cogent points. Here are my points. Here's why you're wrong. 1, 2, and 3. I'm ready for your counterattack. I've already thought about how you're going to argue back, and I'm totally prepared to prove you wrong, right? We spend all this energy. We get really excited about it. And of course, in the midst of this, men make all these straw man arguments, really. They're ridiculous. I think in this moment, what men don't often see is that the commitment to sinfully win, it's really driven by just as much as emotion as your wife is driven by. It's driven by a lot of anger that you don't want to talk about. Instead, you want to be the logical lawyer to give all the points as to why clearly your wife is being so overly emotional and irrational, and clearly, you know, why you were right. And it's all very obvious if you'll just listen to what I'm saying, right? It's a lot easier for men to do this, and it's way less vulnerable for him than to actually do the hard work of talking about the fact that you're really angry. And here's what happened when we went through this fight, when we went through this conflict. It's a lot easier for men. It's safer for men to do this. It's way more safe to go on the offensive in the midst of the fight than what's going on inside of you and saying, I'm angry. I felt hurt when you said this. I was really confused when this happened. And this tactic, again, it's just counterproductive, right? Clearly, because it produces this never-ending cycle of attack and defend. And so the more aggressively you attack your wife, the more defensive she becomes. The more defensive she becomes, the more you're going to ratchet up your arguments, right, to prove that she's wrong. And around it goes. Of course, logic and reason, they can be a part of your conflicts, but we can't use these things to bludgeon our spouse, to make them submit to us, to agree with what we're saying. There are plenty of times in a marriage when a husband needs to see, look, you've made your point. You made it long enough, you made it far enough, and if you continue to push, it's just destructive. It's relationally pushing your wife away. It's going to make her feel hurt and resentful. It's going to alienate her from you. Okay, so those are ways that sinful conflicts go wrong. You guys see yourself in any of these things that I'm saying? Let's talk about ways that we can do conflict in a way that's redemptive. What are some key ingredients of redemptive conflicts, and then what are ways that we can have strategies to do conflict in ways that bless our spouse, that move conflict forward? So I've got a couple things for key ingredients involved in our sinful or in our redemptive ways to do conflict. First is love. This is really obvious, but it's also probably the hardest thing to actually do in the midst of a conflict where your sinful flesh has really pushed hard on you to listen to what it says. You can biblically define love in a lot of ways. A classic great place to go is 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. I've heard Rich say this several times in a couple of sermons. I have no idea where he got it, but it's always stuck with me, and I love it. I think he got it from someone else. I've heard him say there's always a deeper right than being right. There's always a deeper right than being right. So you can win the argument and still completely fail to love your spouse. And men especially, we have to hear this. Husbands, you can win the argument and completely fail to love your wife like Christ loved the church. You can win the argument and completely fail to demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit that your wife needs in the midst of the marital fight. Love is concerned not only about the content of your conflict, but the character and the manner in which your conflicts are conducted. In the midst of conflicts, husbands can easily be seduced by evil into believing that being technically right, or even maybe morally right, is more important than communicating your point with Christ-like love and care and gentleness, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, the fruit of the Spirit. Loving your spouse means you're just as committing to showing them what Jesus is like than you are with the truth involved in a particular conflict. So love is a key ingredient. Humility is another one. Are you willing to question yourself in the midst of your conflicts, in the midst of your anger? When you feel the most justified, when you feel the most right, are you willing to actually slow down and consider, could I be wrong? Humility with a marital conflict means you are always willing to consider and listen ways you've contributed to the problem and how your anger has been more sinful and destructive than redemptive. It means, again, being willing to cross-examine your own anger and consider maybe my moral judgments have gone off the rails, have gone askew. Humility is a willingness to be corrected by your spouse. Proverbs especially is filled with this idea over and over again that wisdom involves being teachable, involves being someone who can be corrected by someone else, admitting that you're wrong. Proverbs 15:31-32, the ear that listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself, but he who listens to reproof gains intelligence. Forgiveness is the third ingredient of all redemptive conflict. It's as essential as all these. Maybe it's the one in which all the other ingredients are connected to in some way. You will be sinned against, right? We know this in marriage. On a regular basis, your spouse will do sinful things. And so what do you do? You must know how to respond to this. And if you ignore your conflicts and your fights and you just never deal with stuff, it's like toxic poison. It'll just slowly kill your marriage over time. I see this in counseling. Like couples that haven't dealt with a conflict that happened 5 years ago, or 6 months ago, or 10 years ago, and it just never has been resolved. There's never been forgiveness that's been asked for. There's never been forgiveness that's been given. And it's just slowly killed off the life of their marriage. The poet William Blake, he said this. He says, the glory of Christianity is to conquer through forgiveness. And I like that a lot. The glory of Christianity is to conquer through forgiveness. See, this pattern of forgiveness throughout the scriptures, it involves people who receive forgiveness and then they're willing to give forgiveness. Right? Think about the parable of the unforgiving servant in Matthew 18. It's one of my favorite ones, where this man's canceled this huge debt that he owes. The enormous gracious thing has been done for him. And then he sees his servant who owes him a much smaller amount, and he starts choking the guy and demands that, you know, he gives the guy, give him what he owes. We do that in marriage, right, all the time. Like, we can think about our spouse's sin in light of our sins against God, and we feel far more fired up and angry and hostile towards what they have done than broken and repentant over our own sin. So being able to forgive starts with actually believing that you need forgiveness as much as your spouse does, and you need that on a regular basis. Paul's words in Ephesians 4 are really good. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. So this pattern involves, again, believing that you need forgiveness on a regular basis, and you're trusting that that forgiveness has been given to you. A refusal to forgive your spouse is a very powerful statement that basically says you're willing to receive a gift that you're not willing to give, the gift of God's forgiveness. It becomes increasingly difficult to refuse to give your spouse if you're someone who regularly recognizes sin in your own life and is trusting and believing the gospel of grace, that God has forgiven me. So now I've got something to give my spouse other than my anger or my resentment. So those are key ingredients that need to be involved. What are the strategies we can use? What are the ways that we can actually do conflicts in ways that are helpful? There's three counterparts to the sinful ways we do conflict. And some of these actually, the three things mirror the other ones in important ways. They can actually look very similar on the outside, but the heart is very different for these. So we've got three things let's talk about. Let's talk about the first strategy is to yield in the conflict. We should note that this redemptive strategy, at least on the surface, may look like, again, like one of the sinful strategies, right? Isn't that just appeasing your spouse? But again, what's happening in your heart and what's driving the behavior is very, very different than what we talked about earlier. This is not about fear. This is not about I'm afraid of the conflict or I'm afraid of losing your approval. This is about me recognizing the old marital advice. It's a huge cliche, but I actually think it's pretty helpful. Like, you pick and choose your battles in marriage. You don't die on every hill. There really are a lot of things in marriage that actually you can compromise on and still have a healthy, good marriage, right? You can compromise on a variety of issues, and nobody's forfeiting their roles as husbands and wives. Sometimes husbands and wives maybe have a rigid view of headship or submission that, again, thinks that A husband who yields to his wife on any issue, right, is not exercising headship. But again, this is not the biblical view. It's not the biblical view of headship that we see in the scriptures. In my experience, there's a variety of conflicts I see in marriages where really it's about somebody who refuses to yield, not in order to protect some biblical command because you're just too selfish or you're too proud to realize that in the big scheme of things, one of us can compromise on the issue and it's just going to be okay. If husbands and wives are growing in their unity on important issues, and that this should be the case, I think, in healthy marriages where they're growing together as one flesh, this means that there really are relatively few hills that you're going to die on. Each side really can concede a lot of ground on a lot of issues, and you're not going to lose something essential that God has called you to do. God calls both men and women in marriage to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. The strategy is necessary action that flows again from humility, a heart that seeks to practically model Jesus' love and humility. Words of Philippians 2 here. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Let each of you need to look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. So you can yield a lot of times in conflicts, and it's really okay. The second thing is you can wait. You can wait. There's times in a conflict where you've said and done everything you know to say, and the more you talk about it, the more hurtful and divisive the issue is becoming. And after careful consideration, you realize that this really is an issue that it would be wrong to compromise about, an issue that you believe has a clear biblical principle or command connected to it. So at this point, you really only have two options. You can either continue to press the issue, hoping your spouse will change, or you can shelf the issue for a time you can come back to it. And in the interim period of time between, you can pray for yourself and for your spouse that if you think your spouse is clearly wrong about something, that God is going to help them see this and you can continue to have this conversation. And you have a sense of patience over the particular issue. One really simple way that husbands and wives have to be able to do this is in the midst of a conflict that gets really bad, you have to be able to know how to put the brakes on it and say, hey, let's just stop for a second. I'm really angry, and I know if I keep going, I'm just going to say really destructive things. Can we come back in an hour and talk about this? I'll tell you what, I need to think about this for about a day or two. I just know in my own heart, I know this is going to go really poorly if I speak right now. Can we shelf this, and can we come back to this? A lot of times in anger, I see this a lot, like if one spouse wants to quickly escape from the conflict, and the other one like chases them, right? So that there's no way to take a break. There's no way to hit the pause button. I mean, it's just like gasoline on the fire, right? You have to be able to hit the pause button when you fight. There's all kinds of things. It's amazing. Like if you read scientifically, like when your body gets super angry, there's physiological things happening that actually make productive conversations difficult. Your blood pressure increases, right? Your heart rate increases. Adrenaline starts to surge through your body. You know, blood flows to your hands when you get super, super mad, right? You're biologically made in that moment to fight. I'm ready to fight. And so, like, actually stopping your argument when you know you're at this point where your anger is super sinful and slowing down, hitting the brakes, letting your body actually recover from some of these things, it'll help you. It'll help you think more clearly and to respond in ways that are redemptive in your marriage. Some conflicts in marriage are so significant, right, that you're not going to solve it by staying up all night. Like, we need to try to have a settle our accounts quickly in marriage. We don't need to let fights go on and on forever. But at some point, you can say, you know what, like, we're just not going to solve this. It's really late, and I'm really tired, and we can go to bed. I love you. We're going to talk about this tomorrow. And then in the meantime, right, you can shelf something, you can wait, and you can humbly ask for God to show you, again, where you might be wrong. A good thing to pray while you wait in the midst of a conflict is something like Psalm 139, search me, O God, know my heart, try me and know my thoughts, see if there's any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. And of course, it's possible also that the conviction only grows over time that you really are fighting for something good and godly and something you have biblical grounds to fight for. So waiting in conflicts is really an important act of faith. It's an act of trusting and believing that God is going to work here, and he's going to get us on the same page. He's going to bring us closer to each other. that I'm not going to fix the fight through sheer willpower, right? I can continue to be gracious and persistent, but I can also trust that if we have the ability to be patient and wait, God is also going to bring us closer in our marriage. Okay, so those are two redemptive strategies. Let's talk about one final redemptive way we can do conflicts. This one is confronting. And this actually may look like winning, right, on the outside. Again, there's some similarities that exist for both. But again, the heart of what drives these two is very, very different. You can speak the truth in love sometimes with your spouse. Sometimes you have to do this. Sometimes silence in the midst of a conflict or shutting down or ignoring, it's just really destructive. And it takes a lot of wisdom to know when to confront and when to pick another strategy. Again, we don't confront on every issue. There are times when love covers over a multitude of sins, as Proverbs tells us. But growing in wisdom and discernment in marriage means that you know what are the issues that I have to confront my spouse over this. I have to say something hard. I have to say something that's very risky that I know will likely make them mad or hurt or angry. But I know that there's something biblical here that God wants us to do that's so vital and important for our marriage that if we ignore this, this is going to be really destructive for us. So again, the strategy on the outside, it may look like winning because it's assertive, it's bold, and it's risky, right? But again, the heart of confronting is not about proving that you're right. That's not the point of what you do when you confront your spouse. It's not about saying, hear all my arguments, right? I don't really care what you think or feel. I'm just going to prove that you're wrong and that I'm right. No, confronting is driven by a deep love for your spouse, by deep care, willingness to suffer the emotional pain that you're going to feel and your spouse is likely going to feel because you know that you're going to honor and love God and do what he's called you to do, even if it hurts. This is a love that's willing to sacrificially suffer the immediate relational pain in order to protect and preserve something that's greater than the emotional pain that you feel. And again, this is very hard for a lot of us to do this, because we can mistakenly equate someone's approval of you for love, right? As long as my spouse is happy with me, everything's great. And I'm doing everything I need to do, and I'm loving them well. That's not always necessarily the case. There are times in marriage when you must be willing to temporarily part ways with your spouse's approval in order to love him or her in ways that they need the most. A guy named Paul David Tripp, some of you may know who he is, he writes this about speaking the truth and love confronting. I like what he says. He says, the truth is that we fail to confront not because we love others too much, but because we love ourselves too much. We fear others misunderstanding us or being angry with us. We are afraid of what others will think. We don't want to endure the hardships of honesty because we love ourselves more than we love our neighbors. Yet we know that the depth of love in a relationship can be judged by the degree of honesty that exists. Biblical rebuke is motivated by the second commandment. You see this kind of thing all throughout the scriptures, right? Matthew 18, how we have to confront sin in the lives of people as an act of love, as a act of seeking to restore them. Proverbs, again, is really helpful, right? Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy. In other words, sometimes love is going to look like a willingness to wound. A wound that isn't driven by anger or vindictive spirit, but a willingness to love and help someone move towards redemptive change. One of the greatest examples we see of this, right, is, you know, 2 Samuel, when Nathan the prophet has to go and confront King David. This is a very dangerous endeavor for him, a very risky endeavor for him. But he clearly sees that David has gone astray. He's done something sinful that must be confronted. And to continue to cover it up is going to be very destructive for him. Okay. End of our first session.